Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Trump escalates his war of words against Elizabeth Warren. The Massachusetts senator says, bring it on.
Pocahontas, I apologize to you. I apologize. To you, I apologize. To the fake Pocahontas, I won't apologize.
Donald Trump wants us to talk about anything other than what's going on in the Trump administration.
Also today, a new documentary tells the story of how the opioid addiction crisis hit one community of friends in Somerville.
We lost a lot of friends over the years, you know. I lost so many that I feel like I got more friends in heaven than I do on the streets.
And as state lawmakers consider a bill to ban cell phone use while driving, we get a lesson in the perils of distracted driving.
So a whole bunch of things were wrong there.
I'll never text again. Not that I do.
That's what everyone says, but somehow it's still a problem.
Yeah.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's begin with politics and the question, how low can we go? No doubt Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren is wondering about that as she fends off what are arguably racist and misogynist comments from President Trump. At a rally in Montana on Thursday, the president took on Warren, once again calling her Pocahontas and demanding that she take a DNA test to prove her claims of American Indian heritage. For good measure, he also mocked the Me Too movement. Yesterday at a town hall meeting in Natick, Warren fired back. Now, there will likely be a lot more of this to come, especially if Warren decides to challenge Trump and run for president, something she says emphatically she's not contemplating. But she has emerged as one of the toughest anti-Trump voices in the country, while Trump is happy to slam the Massachusetts senator as a way to whip up his base. Boston Globe reporter Annie Linsky has been following all this and joins us from Washington. Annie, good to have you back on the show.
Hi, good to talk to you.
So what do you make of this Trump-Warren feud? I mean, clearly the president believes this is a good way to excite his supporters. So let's talk about it from his point of view first. Do you think he's right?
You know, it's interesting. I do think he's right. And I think what happened here, what happened on Thursday at that rally in Montana that you'd mentioned, is something new, which is, you know, Trump has long talked about Warren calling her Pocahontas, but he's never called for her DNA to be collected before. So that was, you know, Trump ramping up his attacks on the senator and making an ask that we're a little more familiar with in Massachusetts because, you know, there have been some sort of characters on the fringe making that request publicly, but to have that as sort of a national request on the, you know, presidential stage was something that represents or, you know, a ramping up on his behalf. And I think it is for exactly the reason that you stated, which is she is somebody who does rile up the Republican base, and somebody, it's, you know, it's red meat for them.
Right.
They really like to kind of, they like to go after her. She isn't as well known, to be honest, you know, in the rest of the country as other women that Trump likes to attack, on Nancy Pelosi or Hillary Clinton, of course. But she is becoming a favorite of his.
So, Eddie, let's listen to a little bit of what the president said on Thursday. As we said, he called her Pocahontas again, chiding her about her claims of Native American ancestry and challenging her to take that DNA test, saying that he will even provide the DNA testing kit. Here's what he said.
We will take that little kit and say, but we have to do it gently because we're in the Me Too generation. So we have to be very gentle. And we will very gently take that kit and we will slowly toss it, hoping it doesn't hit her and injure her arm, even though it only weighs probably 2 ounces. And we will say, I will give you $1 million to your favorite charity, paid for by Trump, if you take the test and it shows you're an Indian, you know.
So, Annie, there's Donald Trump talking Montana on Thursday. As you said, sort of ramping it up and laying down that challenge. He's also taking on the Me Too movement there with a lot of derision. I mean, is there a chance that this could backfire on him? What do you think?
Well, so far, nothing has backfired on this president. So is there a chance? I suppose there is. But I think one of the, you know, what really struck me when I heard that on Thursday and even just hearing it again is there's no obvious connection between this notion that she should provide DNA and the Me Too era, except for in Donald Trump's head. And, you know, I found it fascinating that he would conflate those two things. You know, it's something that I talked to the White House quite extensively about when I was writing my story about it on Friday. And it is a traditionally sort of a non sequitur. I mean, why would her, you know, that's where you began to combine some sort of sense of racism, as Warren has called this moniker Pocahontas that he uses as a racist slur. But this is where you kind of move from racism to misogyny,
right?
Where he is talking about, you know, sort of having this fantasy of being on a stage with her and like throwing something at her. He seems to know quite a lot about DNA kits. He's familiar in his mind with how much they would cost, what they weigh, and has this idea in his mind that he would just be throwing it at her, and then he uses these words, I would do it gently, we would do it gently, which is also not the kind of language that we're accustomed to hearing, you know, from, you know, a city council member, much less a United States president.
Yeah, it's really something. So yesterday in Natick, as we mentioned, Senator Warren responded. She accused Trump of being a bully to women across the country and promised that she wasn't going to sit down and shut up. She also tried to tie the president's attack to his controversial and chaotic immigration policy on the border. Let's listen to a little bit of what she said.
Donald Trump wants us to talk about anything other than what's going on in the Trump administration. I'm 2 weeks from having been down at the border, and Donald Trump's administration took children out of the arms of their mothers and now is too incompetent to reunite them. He doesn't want us talking about that.
So, of course, Warren there is referring to the fact that there are still a couple of thousand of children at least separated from their families. The Trump administration struggling to comply with a federal judge's order to reunite these families. A lot of outrage about this across the country. But there it is. I mean, is this going to have an effect on Trump politically among his supporters, or is that Warren just talking to her base? What do you hear?
You know, I think that was a very a clever response on Warren's part. It's something that she and her team came up with very quickly. As sort of as a political, she put it out on Twitter shortly after he made those remarks in Montana the first time, and then of course has been repeating it. And I think that does speak a little bit to Warren's political team, that they are perhaps ready for this question, ready for this attack from the president, and had an answer for it. I did talk to, for my story, some of the top Democratic strategists in the country who did suggest, you know, alternative responses for her. One person I spoke with, Joel Benison, who, of course, was a pollster to Barack Obama and also to Hillary Clinton, had said, you know, perhaps what she should say is, yes, I'll take that test. I'm happy to do it right after you release your tax returns. In fact, you know, I'll take this from you, and we can meet on the next debate stage, and you give me a pile of those tax returns that you've promised, and I will do this. So I don't know. I mean, I'd imagine that this request for DNA from her has been so, it's been repeated on those sort of fringes of the right for so long. It's not all that surprising that it'll bubble up. And I think that Warren will have to continue to find ways to respond to it. So now, you know, she's sort of using policy and pivoting to a Trump administration policy that is deeply unpopular, not only with the Democratic base, but sort of if you look at polling, sort of also with large swaths of independent voters as well. And so it's sort of very a kind of a clever pivot for her to make. But my sense would be, although I hate to make predictions, my sense would be this is an attack that he's going to continue to make.
Right. So Warren, of course, is facing a challenge for her U.S. Senate from three Republicans for her U.S. Senate seat from three Republicans here in Massachusetts. She's not really acknowledging them. She is acknowledging Trump in a big way. But of course, Jeff Deal, John Kingston, Beth Lindstrom, all running against Elizabeth Warren. So it sort of sounds like she's running against Trump and looking toward 2020. She said again yesterday, and she gets asked this every time she comes in contact with people like us, that she's not running for president. Do you buy that? Right. What do you think?
Well, she's using that sort of Harvard law professor clever use of the verb to be, which is she is not running currently. Although,
right.
I mean, arguably, she certainly is doing things to prepare herself for a run. I mean, look, we all know, we've all been watching Warren for years. We all know that she's very ambitious. You know, in Massachusetts, we are used to having national leaders come from our state, which is something that's great about it. So, you know, I don't think there's any question that this is something that she absolutely is looking at. You know, I would, I don't think that she's made a decision in her head. I don't think she's lying when she says, you know, she is not running currently. I mean, that's because when there's just so much that could change between now and, I don't know, I suppose you've got about 8 months until you'd start. These announcements would start, and a lot can change, and we're looking at what is going to be an extraordinarily crowded field for Democrats. So, I mean, I do think that she's going to have to really make a call as to whether or not she wants to put herself through what would be a grueling primary contest, and then, you know, an absolute bloodfest.
Yes, exactly.
For presidential.
Yep. And she might well decide that sticking in the Senate, she could be even more effective or just as effective, if not more effective there. Annie Linsky, reporter for The Boston Globe. Thanks so much for talking to us, and thank you for your reporting for The Boston Globe. We appreciate it. Stay with us. Coming up, as state lawmakers consider a bill to ban cell phone use while driving, we'll get a lesson in the perils of distracted driving. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Massachusetts lawmakers are considering a bill that would ban cell phone use in cars unless the phone can be used hands-free. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says distracted driving, largely because of cell phones, causes 10% of fatal crashes. The National Safety Council puts the number much higher and estimates that cell phone use accounts for more than a quarter of car crashes. And yet, since 2011, numerous bills to curtail cell phone use in cars have stalled on Beacon Hill, even as 16 other states have enacted them. In a few minutes, we'll hear from parents whose daughter was hit and killed by a distracted driver who are pushing Massachusetts lawmakers to act now. But first, we want to revisit a conversation and demonstration we had back in 2015 about the dangers of distracted drivers and why Massachusetts has been so slow to embrace new safety laws.
Massachusetts, for some reason, we seem to wear being bad drivers as a badge of honor.
So this is Dan Strollo. He's the executive director of the In Control Family Foundation, a nonprofit trying to reduce the number of traffic deaths in the state, especially among teens who are particularly prone to the risks of distractions behind the wheel. Strollo is surprised, even frustrated, that Massachusetts has moved so slowly on this issue.
The reality is we were 50th place for seatbelt use in the state. So when it comes to driving, we don't take it seriously. We're a lot of really well-educated, smart people, and we have one of the worst crash rates in the country. And I'll say, I think people, as a society, we don't realize just how dangerous this stuff is.
Check one.
Yep.
All good.
The In Control Foundation runs driving classes in North Andover that, among other things, simulate just how deadly distractions like cell phones can be in a car.
Yeah, so when I say go, you can accelerate it as quickly as you want.
Okay.
When you reach the right speed.
So I'm behind the wheel with Kevin Stromsky, an instructor at In Control. In this drill, I speed up quickly to about 45 miles per hour and head straight toward a wall of plastic traffic cones. About 180 feet before the cones, a red light on my dashboard flashes, my signal to hit the brakes hard and avoid hitting the cones.
Keep going, keep going. Brake, 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 brake.
Not even close. Slammed right through those cones.
So that was just not getting that pedal down fast enough. You want to slam the brakes.
Slam it, okay, yeah.
So I failed. And the lesson, of course, is this. At high speeds, you cover a lot of ground quickly. 60 miles per hour is 90 feet per second. So a second or two of distraction can be catastrophic. When I try the drill again, I manage to stop in time, but just barely.
Hear the yellow cones, lights, brake.
Oh, man.
Just in time.
Just in time.
Much better.
So it really took just about all of those 85 feet to stop.
Oh, yeah. Now we're going to give you an added challenge.
Okay.
Okay? And this is where we're going to start to see the dangers of a distraction.
In this next drill, I'll speed toward those cones, and then Kevin will hand me a calculator and ask me to key in my birthday. 7 digits, just like a phone number.
At any point while you're doing that, one of these lights are going to come on.
Okay.
And that's a kid running out into the road. So you want to hit the brake pedal as hard as you did.
Okay.
And we'll see the difference in what happens.
Okay.
You ready?
Yep.
Go ahead. Coast? All right. So a couple things happen. One, you're distracted enough that you forgot to coast.
Right.
What is your birthday?
It's 11/03.
All right, so we have 11/1.
Yep.
So we didn't get your birthday right. And then we didn't even hit the brakes nearly as hard as you did last time.
Right.
So a whole bunch of things were wrong there.
Yep.
Even though we just practiced doing it right.
Yep. I'll never text again. Not that I do. Not that I have. But I'm just saying.
That's what everyone says. But somehow it's still a problem.
Yeah. Hi, Dan.
How are you, Anthony?
Well, that was humbling.
I was going to say, so far you're a textbook example, though.
Again, this is Dan Strollo, the executive director of In Control. We're going to do one more drill about the dangers of distractions when you're following a car too closely. For this one, Dan is in the passenger seat and Kevin is driving another car, 2 car lengths ahead of me, but to the left. So when he suddenly stops, I should be able to stop my car before I pass his rear bumper, which would simulate a crash.
If you stop in time, that's no crash, of course. If you start to pass my rear bumper but stop before the middle of my car, we're going to call that what everyone loves to call a fender bender. Now, if you pass the middle of my car and stop before the front bumper of the car, we're going to call that an ambulance ride. Your car is totaled, my car is totaled, and obviously you're not feeling too good. You're off to the hospital. Now, if you pass the front bumper of my car, I like to call it a hearse ride. Worst case scenario.
All right.
So we're going to see how we do.
Kevin, we're ready. You can go ahead.
2, 1, go.
Floor it. Just keep the nose of the car up with that cone and stay off to the side like we are. Watch for his brake lights.
Okay, so not a hearse ride.
Pretty bad fender bender. Almost an ambulance ride.
Almost an ambulance ride, a pretty bad fender bender.
An everyday occurrence as far as our highways go.
We were traveling about 50 miles an hour, and even though I was ready for it, when Kevin slammed on his brakes, I had no way to stop without crashing into him. It's a lesson about keeping a safe distance on the highways and about potentially deadly consequences of distractions like cell phones. And it's why Dan Strollo favors a proposal to ban handheld phones in cars, but he says that doesn't go far enough.
I am one of these people who believes that even on the hands-free device, you should stay off of it. You know, your brain is thinking of other things, and how many of us have been on a hands-free device and missed our exit? But here's where the hands-free device really pays off for us is here in Massachusetts, is it gives the police the ability to really say that person was texting. You know, right now, most of the time, I imagine, if you got stopped and you were texting and driving, it's pretty easy for you to say, I was just dialing my phone. But I think this sort of legislation, if nothing else, it gives people the opportunity to think about just how dangerous this is. Any time we're talking about this stuff is incredibly valuable. I hope it passes, but then I hope we reconsider, like, do we even want people using hands-free devices?
So I have another question about the way we handle driving safety in this country. I've lived abroad, and I know, for example, in Europe, to get a driver's license, much more rigorous testing.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And kids are routinely flunked the first two or three times when they try to get it. Doesn't happen here. Do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, I really do. I think, and again, this is a legislative matter. I'd love to see us take driver's education more seriously. I think the driving schools that exist out there are doing exactly what the state is asking of them for the most part. I mean, there's certainly some schools that could improve, but their goal is to get kids their license. In Massachusetts, when you take that driver's test, the driving time is somewhere between 3 to 5 minutes. Maybe on a weird day, it's 10 minutes of driving. Germany, you go to get your license, it's an hour behind the wheel. Estonia, not only is it an hour behind the wheel, but you have to go on highways, city streets, and then put the car in a skid and prove you can regain control before they'll give you a license. And even then, it's a temporary license. You got to come back and get a full permit once there's inclement weather that they can test you in. So very different societal attitude towards what goes into learning to be a better driver. Here, if you wait until you're 18, you don't even need to have any driver's ed. You can just show up and take the test and take it once a week or every, you know, couple of weeks until you pass. It isn't, you know, it's a numbers game.
Yeah, I think a good way to think about it, someone said to me years ago that when you get your license, it's a license to learn. It doesn't mean you know how to drive.
Exactly.
What explains that?
There's something about driving that it's a God-given right, and then I think as parents, we just look at it, and I can't tell you how many parents I've met who've had kids injured, you know, brain injuries where they've said, geez, I knew they were going to crash. I just never thought it would be this bad. And that's what it boils down to. Is
every parent's living nightmare.
It is. Yeah. And but we don't necessarily proactively. I mean, that part of what we're talking to parents about now is really modeling the right behavior. You know, once that car seat turns around, they're watching you. If you think you can talk on the phone or you can play around with things while you're driving or have, you know, high speed situations or tailgating or whatever it is that you're doing, they're watching you. And the day they get their license, whether you've told them not to or not, they think they can.
I'm worried. One of the things I want to ask you about, Dan, is just how technologically evolved the dashboards are becoming in cars. I mean, we drive a car for WBUR. It's a very nice Subaru. It's got all kinds of safety measures. But there is so much information going on the dashboard that it concerns me, actually.
Where I start to struggle is what you're seeing on the dashboards. I mean, for you to be able to update your Facebook page while you're driving is ludicrous and takes everything away from it. But even, you know, some of the display information, telling you additional information about the songs you're listening to, things that just distract your eye. In a perfect world, we're staying more engaged.
So that's Dan Strollo. He's the executive director of the In Control Family Foundation, a nonprofit trying to reduce the number of traffic deaths in Massachusetts. We spoke to him back in 2015. And joining us live now in the studio are Rich and Anna Cheshire Levitan, who are urging state lawmakers here in the state to pass a bill that would prevent handheld cell phone use while driving. And here's why. Back in July 2013, their 18-year-old daughter, Merritt, a recent graduate of Milton Academy, was biking with a group in Arkansas when a vehicle struck her and several others in the group. The driver was texting when he hit the cyclist. Merritt was rushed to the hospital but died of her injuries the next day. So, Rich and Anna, thank you for coming in. Of course, I'm so sorry for your loss, but thank you for coming in and talking about this important subject, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
So, what gave you the motivation, first of all? I mean, I can only imagine how difficult that must have been for your family, but to turn your grief into this kind of activism. Let me start with, I don't know who wants to answer that, but go ahead, Anna.
Okay, I'll start. First of all, this was founded, Text Less, Live More, which is a national awareness campaign to end distracted driving, was founded by Merritt's classmates at Milton. So we actually followed their lead.
Wow.
They came together when they heard that Merritt had been killed by a distracted driver, and they thought, what can we do as the digital generation to examine our own use of phones and technology? And they came up with Text Less, Live More. And the very first event, Text Less, Live More event, was held at Milton Academy in September 2013, and the entire school and administration turned off their phone for the entire day.
Yeah. Can you bring us back to what we can understand about what happened that terrible day? Was this just a terrible case of someone not paying attention and just plowing into these people, including your daughter? Is that what happened?
That's exactly what happened. Young man, 21 years old, made a terrible mistake, awful consequences.
Yeah.
The road in Arkansas that Merritt was on with her group 12 cyclists in total, was a long, straight country road, two lanes. I went to that road to see the scene of the accident. It was a mistake. It was an error in judgment. Mm-hmm. Wasn't against the law.
Yeah. I mean, what he was doing.
What he was doing was not against the law. He was using his phone. He was texting while he was driving. It was not against the law in Arkansas, but it has tragic consequences.
Right. Of course, there is a law in this state. You can't text while driving, but you can use the phone to make phone calls. Now, I understand that you both live in Georgia, where a law banning cell phones while driving just went into effect. Now you're turning your attention to Massachusetts. Tell me why.
We have a place here, too, as well, so we consider dual citizenship.
Sure.
We know that the fatality and crash rates are going down in the state of Georgia year to date. Even prior to it going into effect, there was a reduction 10%. That equals about 500 people. We just found out today that as of 4th of July weekend, that rose 13%. So we know that a handheld law will save lives and prevent crashes associated with distracted driving. Merritt was born in Boston at Brigham and Women's. She went to Milton Academy. Her entire life was spent in Massachusetts. So in the fifth year anniversary of our tragic loss, it's very fitting for us to come and tell our story.
You know, when I first had that conversation with Dan Strollo about distracted driving, it was back in 2015. And back then, the legislature was considering a piece of legislation that would ban driving while holding a cell phone. And that got bogged down. It didn't pass. A number of bills have gotten bogged down over the years here in Massachusetts. Why? Because this seems like common sense to me. But why? What's, can you, as folks who have followed this for obvious reasons, why is it so hard to pass this? Any ideas?
It's hard to understand why Massachusetts has such a difficult time with this piece of legislation. And if you look at the other New England states, all but Maine and Massachusetts have hands-free laws. Yeah. Rhode Island's went into effect on June 1. To the best of our understanding, at least in 2018, it's all about prioritization. You know, granted, there are a lot of things that our state legislators need to consider on an annual basis. Why hands-free legislation is not near the top of the list, that's why we're here.
Yeah, right. So plain and simple, what's your message to state legislators?
Bring it to a vote.
Bring it to
it's what Massachusetts wants. 74% of Massachusetts voters support hands-free legislation. And according to a 2017 AAA poll, distracted driving ranks number one in terms of the top three concerns for Massachusetts drivers. It's what the people want.
Well, let me bring in a state representative who's good enough to join us today, State Representative Byron Rushing of Boston. Thank you for joining us. I think we've got you on the line right
now. Yes, I'm here.
I really appreciate it. Now, I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you did have some concerns about the bill at the beginning. Tell me how you've been listening to this conversation. Do you support it at this point?
The question that is before us, who are concerned about police behavior. So we have an ongoing question around police behavior in traffic stops, and that there is a disproportionate amount of stops and follow-up action based on race, what we usually call racial profiling.
Right.
And so we have taken a position, those of us who support ending racial profiling have taken a position several years ago in the Massachusetts legislature that we would not support any primary enforcement by police until that primary enforcement was directly connected to ending and making illegal racial profiling by Massachusetts police.
Right.
And that first focused on the issue of seatbelt enforcement. And right now, Massachusetts does not have primary enforcement of seatbelt irregularities, and because we cannot get the support of the police across the state to combine that with strong anti-racial profiling provisions.
So
now, that was a position that most, I think, Massachusetts legislators supported. But I have to be honest, there were certainly legislators who supported that who didn't think it was going to happen and didn't support private enforcement anyway. But that's how legislatures work.
So where are we today? I mean, with this particular piece of legislation, have your concerns been satisfied?
My concerns have begun to be satisfied.
Right.
Let me say this. I really appreciate the fact that several weeks ago, Rich and Anna reached out to me when they heard of my concerns.
Thank you, Byron.
Hi.
We love you.
So they called me, and I was able to hear their tragic story of the loss of their daughter, and I'm telling you what I told them.
Yeah.
That racial profiling is a serious both public safety problem in this state, but people need to understand that for the people who are affected by it, it is also a public health problem. I mean,
Representative Rushing, I get that. I just want to. Right. I've been dying to ask a question. Let me just ask this question, and I want you to continue. But the question that I've been puzzled by, and I'm sure there's a clear answer here, is why are these two things linked? In other words, why can't we pass legislation outlawing racial profiling and pass legislation that just says you can't drive while holding a cell phone because it's dangerous?
We could do both of those things if both of those things happened at the same time. And now the Senate, and so what happened in the state Senate was that when racial profiling came before the state Senate, when distracted driving came before the state Senate, there was no mention in the committee's bill about racial profiling. And on the floor of the Senate, during the debate, an amendment was made and passed, including most of us consider important language toward ending racial profiling and traffic stops.
I see.
And I support that language.
Hmm.
Perfect.
And so we're at the point where if this bill came before us with that language, then I can support this bill.
Okay.
If this bill and if in some convoluted way this bill came to the House without that language, I would put in an amendment, just like certain senators put in an amendment.
Got it.
On the Senate side.
Representative Rushing, stick with us. I want to just ask Anna and Rich if they're, are you satisfied with what you're hearing? Does it sound to you
Yes.
like Beacon Hill is getting closer to what you want?
We're very hopeful, and thank you, Byron, so much. We had a wonderful conversation, and personally, we are on your side. We never want racial profiling anywhere, and personally, I've worked very hard towards that with certain initiatives in my own life.
Right, and I learned a lot about that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, we're going to look for your support, Byron. We don't want people to be profiled, at all, but we also want to save lives. And we, like you, believe we can get both, and we just hope that everyone works together before the 31st, July 31st, when it ends, to put it to a vote with a language that you feel comfortable with. We'll feel comfortable with it. You know, racial profiling will go down, God willing, and fatalities will go down. Mm. And that's our whole platform right now.
Yes, Representative Rushing, I gather there's a bit of a legislative deadline here at the end of the month. I mean, if you were to sort of place odds on this, what are the odds that this will happen?
I try not to do that.
A good answer. I would have expected nothing less.
Gambling, but I try not to do that. All I can say is we have made those who believe that racial profiling language should be in this bill have made our position clear, and we are like people outside of the legislature trying to get this bill come before us before the end of July.
Awesome.
All right. Well, Representative Rushing, Byron Rushing of Boston, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Byron.
Very, very grateful.
Thank you both.
You'll be hearing from us.
I know that.
All right. Representative Byron Rushing joining us there. So let me just ask you both, Anna and Rich, about the penalty. So the law would include a $100 fine for the first offense, $250 for the second, for the third, $500 fine plus an insurance surcharge. Is that enough to deter someone from using their phone while driving?
It's better than nothing.
Yeah.
It's a good start. What we've seen in Georgia is the awareness of the issue, which was raised when that piece of legislation was passed on May 1st, as Anna shared, has led to a significant decrease in fatalities on the roads of Georgia.
Right.
The fines in Georgia, I believe, are less than the fines you just quoted for the legislation that's in front of the House.
Okay.
So is it enough? It's enough. It'll create a significant amount of awareness when this legislation gets passed before the end of July. People know it's an issue. Most people acknowledge
you can't miss
it's an
it.
Issue.
I mean, you see people driving by all the time.
Right.
Looking at their phones.
Right.
Whether you're
in a car
or on
you're
a bike or standing on the side of the road.
Right. Walking across the street. You have to be aware.
Okay. Rich and Anna Cheshire Levitan lost their daughter Merritt 5 years ago when she was struck by a distracted driver. They're now advocates against distracted driving. There's going to be a rally at the State House on Wednesday to push for passage of this bill. Thank you both so much for coming
Thank
in.
You.
We're very grateful.
At 12:30.
At 12:30.
Thank you.
Okay. That's it. Stay with us. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. In 2016, roughly 64,000 people died of opioid-related drug overdoses across the U.S. In Massachusetts, just last year, there were more than 2,000 opioid-related deaths. The epidemic has hit close to home for Alex Hogan of Somerville. Since 2001, it's killed more than a dozen people he grew up with, including three of his closest friends. Hogan tells their stories and the story of a community hit hard by the opioid epidemic in his new film, Runnin', which won Best Short Documentary Film at the Global Cinema Festival of Boston. Here's a brief bit from the opening of the film.
One day we were going to a wake, and my daughter came to me and said, "I can't find my wake skirt." She was in the eighth grade.
We all grew up together, and our parents grew up together. The ripple effects of one death affects all of us.
To think of all the people that we know that have passed and to think of what they could be doing right now, it's a terrible tragedy is what it is.
Alex Hogan, who directed Runnin' with Matthew Orr, is a multimedia journalist at Stat News, the Boston Globe's online health and life sciences publication, and he joins us now. And Alex Hogan, thanks for coming in, and congratulations on the film.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you grew up in Somerville, and in this film you describe how the current opioid epidemic really hit your community just as you and your friends were going through high school. So tell us how you saw this epidemic take hold of your community and group of friends. What happened?
Yeah, I'd say the first I really started hearing about OxyContin at all was around the early 2000s. Pharmacies were being robbed in the neighborhood, and I started hearing about it just generally being a kind of a new drug du jour of the moment. People started abusing it. No one really understood what it was and how dangerous and addictive it could be. I think the idea was, if it's prescribed by a doctor, how bad, could it be?
Right. Not to mention, and you make this point in the film that Purdue Pharma was actually promoting it as safe.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we'd go into that quite a bit in the film. Their marketing practices were, quite obscene, to be honest, just because they knew what they had and how addictive it was. And what would happen is that as it got, very successful commercially, it became very successful in the black market as well. And yeah, a lot of kids started experimenting with it, and unfortunately, the addiction is so strong with it. The withdrawal symptoms are so bad that when the because of all the robberies and pharmacies and they started stop carrying it as much, it became harder to get. That's where at that point, a lot of people had to switch to heroin because heroin's actually pretty chemically similar to OxyContin. So when you're withdrawing from OxyContin, you can use heroin to get to stave off your withdrawal symptoms. And then once the heroin came in, that was probably the mid-2000s. That's when we really started to lose people.
Yeah. Speaking of losing people, you focus on the deaths of three of your lifelong friends, Sean Curtis, Alex Foster, and Kevin Sullivan. Mm-hmm. What did they have in common? What did their deaths say about who this epidemic was hitting?
Yeah, I think the three things we kind of focused on with those three characters, my friends, was was that they all kind of had something in their lives that they seemed to be kind of self-medicating a little bit. Mm-hmm. Kevin lost his younger brother. Sean was just, you know, Sean was a very outgoing person, but I think he had his own demons. Alex Foster struggled with anxiety. And then my other friend, Marky, who's in the film that... you know, he's still with us. He's you know, having some success in recovery now. But he said, you know, he had really wanted to fit in, and he felt like he like had some social anxiety. So yeah. I think everyone in their own ways are like using drugs in a way to run away from their problems. And that's kind of one of the themes we actually in the title Runnin', is we kind of felt that they're using drugs to mask some of their personal issues. And I think that's one thing they had in common. And the other thing they had in common is they're all really good kids.
Yeah.
You know, these weren't that. You know, that's one of the goals of the film is to destigmatize people with drug use disorders, and as they're just normal, good people.
Well, I want to ask you about. You mentioned your friend Kevin Sullivan, or Sully, who died of an overdose, and his addiction escalated after the death of his younger brother Ryan.
Yes.
So I want to hear a scene from the movie. So in this scene, we'll hear his sister Brianna talking about that, and then we hear you reading from Sully's journal, I guess. So let's listen to that.
He was huge in helping me get through Ryan's death, but he didn't get through it. That night definitely changed everything for my family.
Some of Sully's writings expressed the hurt he was feeling and how he abused alcohol and drugs to relieve his pain. He wrote, "What makes a man with a nasty taste for strong drink and recreational drug use, a strict regimen of which I undertake to avoid dealing with my five dead friends and dead brother? Enough guys to play a regulation hockey game."
That line is so powerful, enough guys to play a regulation hockey game. And, you know, how did you, when you discovered that piece of writing, how did you react?
Oh, it was incredibly moving. Brian was kind enough to share that with me. And, you know, Kevin was one of the, I say this as an exaggeration, maybe one of the smartest people I've ever known. Mm-hmm. And to, you know, he's so eloquent, and to just see that I didn't know him as someone that like kept a journal.
Yeah.
So to see those words from beyond and to see that he was, you know, what he was struggling with at the time. I mean, we all knew he was struggling, but when you'd see him, you know, he was always very outgoing and very, very funny. And whenever you bumped into him, he'd never give you any signs that he was what his struggle was, but we all knew.
Yeah.
So to see him articulate it in that writing was, you know, incredibly powerful.
But did you know he was, I mean, when he, did you know at the time before he died that he was struggling with heroin and OxyContin?
Yeah, I did. I know. He came to my house one time just unannounced. This goes to show how smart he was.
Yeah.
I just explained to him, I was living in Dorchester at the time. I had explained to him just where I lived just very generally one time, and he just 6 months later showed up my house. He remembered like where I lived.
Yeah.
And you know, he showed up at my front door, and he was clearly, you know, under the influence. And I had known, I had actually bailed him out of jail once. I mean, so yeah, it was tough because you knew that he was clearly trying to self-medicate. I mean, he was dealing with a lot. The loss of his brother was incredibly tragic.
Yeah. You also, as you mentioned, profile Marky Pantanella, who struggles to this day with opioid addiction. In the film, you talk to him about his addiction, about how he behaved at parties, beat up people, stole things from his families, from his family members. So let's listen to a bit of that.
Robbing my mom, my dad. Like, you know, it's been insane, right? Like, I didn't sit there and say, I want to hurt my mom and dad, right? Absolute torture. I mean, I was an emotional terrorist. You know what I mean? They were heartbroken. They didn't know what to do. Their hands were tied behind their back, and I was literally running all over their hearts, you know?
So the first thing I want to ask about Marky, how's he doing now? Because in the film, we see him relapse, or he disappears. We don't see him. We understand that he has relapsed. But then at the end of the film, he seems to be okay.
Yeah, I actually just ran into him just last weekend at Assembly Row. He looks great. Yeah. He's working right next to where my folks live, and my folks see him all the time. And I guess he's, from what all I can tell, he's doing great.
Good, that's good. Yeah. What did you learn in profiling these friends, close friends of yours, in particular the folks who died? What did you learn about the sort of profile of who is susceptible, or was there? Or is it wrong to talk about one profile about who is susceptible?
Yeah, that's the thing is, I think what I one of the things I came away with is there is almost very little rhyme or reason. I think that there is one thing that they did have in common for the most part was that they had their self-medicating an issue of one way or the other. But but I think there's other examples of people that I didn't profile that I don't know that they necessarily were. I think they just are experimenting with drugs like high school kids do.
Yeah.
And it got their hooks on them because it's so highly addictive.
Yeah.
And why some people do and some people don't is a question I've been kind of wrestling with for a long time, even before I made this film. For why didn't I ever?
Right, because you make the point in the film that even though these guys were your buddies, you didn't get you didn't go down that road.
Yeah. And
why do you think that is?
Yeah, that's something I've been wrestling with for quite a while. I just I think I may have there was that. Since like, oh, it's because it's prescribed by a doctor, how bad could it be? I think I kind of had an understanding that that's not necessarily true.
Yeah.
But that's not to say that I couldn't have been tempted by it at some point or another. And I wrestled with it in the film, and I've wrestled with it even before I was involved in this project at all. Just, you know, how come some of my friends that were raised right, you know, same, very good families, just like mine, same street, same sports, same, you know, exact same demographics. Used drugs and I didn't. I'm not quite sure.
One of the themes that you remind us about in the film is that Somerville used to have a very different kind of reputation than it has today, perhaps. It was a place for tough guys. Whitey Bulger's Winter Hill Gang was based there for a while. So here is your friend Mike Curtis. He's a firefighter, describing how people used to react to hearing where he was from.
When I lived far away from here and people would ask me where I'm from, I would say Boston. And they said, really, where in Boston? I said Somerville. They were like, oh, my condolences. I'm sorry. I didn't hear that.
So Somerville, of course, different today. And this comes up a few times in the film, like a few neighborhoods around Boston, it's been gentrified in a big way. How does that contribute to the way the opioid epidemic hit your community, in your view?
I think it definitely had contributed because I think it happened very much coincided with my group of friends' age group is that, you know, when we were kids, it was a place our parents, you know, very much working class, blue collar place. You know, I got that exact same line too before, like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that you're from Somerville.
Slummerville,
exactly.
Yeah, right.
And then just as we're getting to the age in which you can start looking for your own place and a job, no longer, it's just completely unattainable to live there because the gentrification drove the, you know, apartment and house prices just through the roof. And I think there's a little bit of like difficulty with that, you know, like not having your home doesn't feel like your home anymore. And I think you see in other communities across the country that are having a hard time with the opioid epidemic that they are often like Rust Belt towns or Appalachia where their industries are no longer there anymore. And they look at, you know, these far away cities as you know, thriving, and they're
so it's almost a sense almost that the rug has been pulled out from under
exactly.
You.
So it's happened. That same thing kind of happened to Somerville, that the lifestyle that of, you know, being able to just have a blue collar job and stay in your city and just like your parents did and their parents got pulled out from under them.
Yeah.
But you still got to see the, you know, others come in, you know, in your town and completely price you out. And I just think there was a little bit, people lost their sense of identity and a little sense of their of home. And I think that, you know, was not certainly far from the only factor, but a contributing factor. A lot of the kids were angry about that and resentful about that. And I think that adds to a cycle of use.
Well, Alex Hogan, he's the director of Runnin' with Matthew Orr. He's also a multimedia journalist at Stat News. Alex, thanks for coming in, and thanks for the film. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And by the way, a link to the film can be found at our website, radioboston.org. That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.